Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello. I don't know what that was.
No?
Hello?
Hello, we are right. Bayek. That's a throwback. Hello, everybody.
To end this for all the fields. Aye, pull up a pew. You look like your fatty would be bitter, eh?
To be fair, based on that photo I sent you the other day, this did used to be all fields.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, everywhere around here has been built. They looked at Blade Runner and went, that's an aspirational future. And the rest of us are like, no, it's not. Anyway, enough of that. Hello, lovely listener.
Hello.
Welcome back to Hey Kids Comics 2. No, I'm not even happy with that, to be honest with you.
Are we still? I thought we'd decided.
We decided we're not the return anymore.
Right,
because
okay.
we've now come. just before the kill, some might say.
Some might say.
So we decided that we're not that anymore.
Yeah.
But we haven't actually decided. So we're just settling on two. Okay. Even though, if you want to be pedantic about it, two is the specials that we carried on doing after the first volume ended.
Well, I'm not pedantic about it.
Yeah. Right, okay. Hey Kids Comics 2. The Wrath of Khan.
The Returned.
The Returned.
The Came.
Anyway, today, we need to do Clone Saga Chronicles catch up.
We do
the... For the four people in the audience that love that we do Clone Saga. So as of this writing, here is this massive Vagrant Killing omnibus.
Mm-hmm.
So... Clone Saga Volume 2.
Are we still in the same volume as last time?
Yes, but not as far as they're concerned.
Right.
Oh, no, I wasn't. No, I was still at the end of Volume 1 last time, wasn't
no.
I? Does this have Amazing Spider-Man 400 in it? No, it doesn't. So I was still in Volume 1 the last time we mentioned this.
Right.
I've now finished Volume 1.
Okay.
And I'm, what, 3/4 of the way through Volume 2? Right, this is where it... Let's be honest, struggles a little bit. So you get to Amazing Spider-Man 400. Amazing Spider-Man 400 is one of the single best issues of Spider-Man ever created, bar none. I will brook no argument.
Okay.
It suffers only from subsequent retcons that was an actress playing Aunt May.
Right, yeah.
And that
okay,
neither Peter, nor Ben, nor Mary Jane, nor Aunt Anna noticed that wasn't Aunt May.
Right.
And that actor was so dedicated to her craft, she literally died for the role. Which begs the question, right? Is Aunt May's gravestone still in that grave?
Or did they just have to go back and
they have to go back and say, sorry, comics, she's not actually dead, and they've saved it for when she does actually die?
And then Civil War happened, and they're saying guy's got to go back and go, bloody hell.
Like, Tom Baker's got his own gravestone.
Right, okay.
He has it already. He just doesn't have the year that he died, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
Hopefully he's going to be here for many years to come because he's the mighty Tom Baker. But anyway, so yeah, Amazing Spider-Man 400 is great. In reading along with The Life of Riley, which if you've never read that, that's a brilliant internet piece that somebody did with interviews with the writers
right
at the time talking about the Clone Saga. So I'm reading along with that as I'm going into the behind the scenes stuff. It should have finished with Amazing Spider-Man 400.
Okay.
Should have completed the... They decided, no, we're not going to do that because it's selling.
Yeah.
So it proceeded to carry on through many more padded storylines of who is Ben Reilly, who is Peter Parker, who is the Scryer. Peter Parker goes on trial for murder. Now, this was clever, right?
Mm-hmm.
I actually quite liked this because I'm reading this story going, right, surely Peter can accommodate for the murders happening all the way in Utah, which is a fair distance from New York, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a good couple of miles down the road. So it would have taken him a while. So I'm sure he could say, well, I was in the Daily Bugle around that time.
And would be on camera.
And would be on CCTV. Or worst case, the check that he gets paid with, because it was still checks back then, he will have signed it on the date that he was there. Turns out the murder that he's wanted for, the murder happened coincidentally in the 2 weeks that he was buried alive by Kraven in Kraven's Last Hunt. And there is a part of me that had that exact reaction.
No, that's genius, that is. That is genius.
There's a part of me that did that, and there's a part of me that was, oh, and then I sat and thought about it and thought, well, no, at least they've actually thought about it.
That is the funniest thing they could have done.
Yeah. So,
and it's not like they made that up as well. That is something that did happen.
He was literally buried alive for 2 weeks by Kraven just after he got married to Mary Jane. So even Mary Jane's like, oh, I can't say he was buried alive by Kraven the Hunter.
So he literally has no alibi.
And I thought, okay, that's That's quite genius in its own way. But the problem, right, is that at this point, there were so many supplementary titles. You've got Amazing Spider-Man, you've got Web of Spider-Man, you've got Spectacular Spider-Man.
Right.
You've got, he's currently New Warriors. Scarlet Spider takes a job with the New Warriors to give Ben Reilly a purpose in life.
Right.
And then there's the Super Spider-Man Sensational 5 part that run over summer. And then the Spider-Man Unlimited that comes out quarterly. And you can't help but an awful lot of it be padded.
Mm.
So then they do Spider-Man Goes on Trial.
Right.
And that's what it is. And it just goes on and on and on. And I was going to send you this as a video, and I don't think I did. I think you get to Planet of the Symbiotes, which you can skip because it's really all about where the Venom symbiote comes from. But there's something like, oh, I wish I'd marked the page. There was, it says in here that Spider-Side is another Peter Parker clone. So you get another one.
Spider-Side.
Yeah. They've decided to make the Jackal into the Joker for some reason. He talks like the Joker. Maximum clonage runs for like 6 issues. That's not great. The end of Max here. I think it is here. I think it's here at the end of Maximum Clonage. I did like the art of Sal Buscema with Bill Sienkiewicz.
Right.
I thought that was quite unusual. That was quite interesting. And I like that sometimes they'll mess around with the panel layouts and have things go aside. They finally kill the Jackal.
Right.
So they're finally making some momentum, but Gwen Stacy's still alive.
Wait, Gwen Stacy's back?
Yeah.
Because she's a clone, obviously. She's a clone, yeah.
She was married to Miles Warren.
Right.
A clone of Miles Warren. So they're still up there. And it all gets very, very convoluted. Right, here it is. So the who will be Spider-Man? Find out who stays and who goes next week in Web of Spider-Man 128, chapter 1 of Exiled, right? Exiled is literally, as he scrolls through the pages, there you go. There is Web of Spider-Man 128. How many pages are in between that?
Okay, yeah.
And it's, is this ever going to end? And some of them are good. There's a nice little story in here with Gene DeWolf in it. And there's a nice little story about Peter Parker as a kid. But there's this interminable one, which is has got the lizard in it. Can't even remember what it's called. It's the flip book story at the back of Planet of the Symbiote. So it's 6 issues. And my God, it's boring. It is. It's genuinely just dull. So you finally get to Exiled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I'm currently up to, lovely listener. I'm up to part two of Exiled. Part one of Exiled, you think this is going to be the end of it. This is going to be the conclusion. The end of Exiled, it finishes. Peter Parker has decided, oh, well, I'm not a waste of space after all. I'm genuinely real.
Yeah.
And Ben Reilly has said, you go and be Spider-Man in New York with Mary Jane. I'm going to hit the road like Kane from Kung Fu or Dr. David Banner with my bottomless brown bag.
Yeah.
And I'm going. And you think, oh, well, that's the end then. No. On the first page of Exile Part 2, Ben Reilly starts to leave New York and then goes, why should I leave?
Right, okay.
That's what it's like all the way through. You get to a point where you think they're finally going to do an ending to it, and it doesn't. So at the moment, I am. There's another quarter of this book yet to do. So if you have a look on the Exiles, there. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. There's 18 more issues in this omnibus. Now, four of them is Spider-Man The Lost Years.
Okay.
Which is a Ben Reilly miniseries by J.M. DeMatteis and John Romita Jr. That was really good.
Okay.
I liked those miniseries about what Ben was up to when he was off just wandering the world. And then one of them is the Parker Years, where that's Marvel trying to convince you that your Marvel Comics collection of the past 20 years isn't now worthless.
Right.
Because Peter Parker mattered.
Yeah.
In whatever way. And four of them are New Warriors comics. Let's be honest, nobody cares. So there's quite a lot of that that looks like padding to me.
Yeah.
So as soon as I get through that...
How much of this... It's kind of, you know what we were saying about Nightfall, where a lot of it was just, it wasn't the story, it was just the status quo of the time. Mm. How much of this is the opposite of that, where it's this is a continuing story, but it's spiraling all over the place. It should have been a status quo change.
It's that.
Right.
When you read Life of Riley, which is still out there on the interwebs, they were at one point going to publish it as a book.
Okay.
With new interviews and a... whatever, but it, for some reason that never happened. I don't know why, but it's still out there on the internet, so you can find it. The main guy they've got is the editor at the time, Glenn Greenberg, and him saying that by the time you get into Maximum Clonage and the cliffhanger ending, and here's another clone of Peter Parker, even he's like going, have we just done this?
Right.
But apparently marketing just kept saying, this is selling, keep going. And they just had, but also to refer, to call it something that is now common parlance, but wasn't back then, they needed so much content.
Mm.
If you have a look at it, it's not just Amazing and Spider-Man and Spectacular and Web Off. You've got these one-off miniseries, the Spectacular Spider-Man Planet of the Symbiotes mini going on in the middle of it. And you've got Maximum Clonage 1 and 2, bookending the Maximum Clonage story. You've got him over in New Warriors. You've got all the backup stories that you need.
I wonder how much of this kind of paved the way for what we're kind of used to now, when you get in so many events that's just like, will spin off into other things. Yeah. They'll have their own miniseries coming out of that. You've got your bookend titles.
Well, that's, everyone likes to dunk on the Clone Saga. And I'm one of them.
Right.
Because an awful lot of this, there's an awful lot of fat in this. That if you were making a definitive Clone Saga volume, you could trim very easily. That being said, it was selling.
Yeah.
At a time when Marvel was spiraling around the toilet bowl into bankruptcy.
Right, okay.
Because this is where Heroes Reborn came from, and them licensing their characters out to Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld.
Clone Saga did not save Marvel from bankruptcy, did it?
Clone Saga and X-Men were selling, and that's the bottom line. So Clone Saga was keeping them in the black.
Right.
So you can understand why they'd want to keep it going, even though creatively, it's gasping.
So they did put all of their eggs in one basket, even though half of those eggs might have been cracked already.
Yeah. And it's more a case of you think it's going to come to an end now, and it's like the end of Lord of the Rings. You think you've finally said a teary goodbye to Frodo and Samwise one last time, and oh no, there's another ending. And it's like that. So I honestly, I am at the point now, as much as I'm enjoying the 90s excess of it at all, and how fair play to these creatives for being able to keep that wheel spinning as long as they did, I am very much looking forward to getting to the end of this and getting onto the Ben Reilly stuff, which is good.
Is the Clone Saga the Be Here Now of comics?
Yes, it's the one, I suppose it's the one everybody hates.
Let's get a bunch of writers and artists in one room and just give them an infinite supply of cocaine and just let them do whatever they want.
Well, I just want to say for the record, Greenberg in Life of Riley never once properly mentions that hard drugs are used. So let's just put, before somebody sues us, we don't want to mention that at all. So that's where Clone Saga Chronicles is up to at the minute, lovely listener. Please continue to tune in.
If you might be enjoying this Clone
Saga. The only sad thing is I wish you still lived at home so you could be reading it at the same time.
Right.
So that you could chip in as well.
And we just become a Clone Saga podcast.
What am I thinking is you should take volume home with you today.
Right, okay.
And then for next time, you should give us your thoughts on the first omnibus. Right.
So we'll just re-talk about things we've already covered, but just...
A segue that should win us an award, talking about things we've already covered, Superman Earth 1. It's like you planned that.
I know, it's good, isn't it?
I'm dead in... That should win us a podcasting award.
My power to BS is uncanny.
That segue should win us a podcasting award. Yes, today, lovely listener, we are looking at Superman Earth 1 by J. Michael Straczynski and Shane Davis for the first two volumes, and Adrian Sayaf and Sandra Hope and Barbara Ciardo, do you think that is? For volume 3. We have, as Michael just alluded to in his brilliant segue that took us from one topic to another topic in such a seamless way that if some blithering idiot hadn't brought attention to it, you would have thought that was genius piece of podcasting.
Oh, thank you for explaining what the word segue means. I was a bit unsure until...
So anyway, yes, we have covered Superman Earth 1, Volume 1, in a previous incarnation of this very show.
I don't remember it, so it'll be like talking about it again for
the first
time.
Well, that's what I thought, and I also thought it would be fun to do all three as a gestalt.
Okay.
Because it's over.
Yeah.
You know, it ended. It came to a very definitive conclusion that left no threads dangling whatsoever for future volumes. It is a three-volume series. And we're like, so we've covered Earth 1 before. So Earth 1, for those that are unfamiliar, was a line of graphic novels that was originally mooted as being DC's answer to Marvel's phenomenally successful Ultimate line of comics. However, Whereas Marvel had used the ultimate idea to reboot many of their characters from the beginning, albeit with a more modern edge, as monthly comics, and then collect those comics into six-issue collections, DC elected to skip the middleman and release these directly as hardcover graphic novels, not collections of previously published material. Now, some have decried this as a bad business plan, because if you publish the six issues of the comic, the idea is that that starts selling and starts generating your revenue back more quickly, and then the collected edition adds to that revenue in some way, but also keeps it on the shelf for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
As we are well aware, Ultimate Spider-Man went into many reprintings of the initial trade, didn't it?
Yeah.
And stuck around for ages. I think you can walk into a shop now and get the Volume 1 Ultimate Collection, which is the first 12 issues. I think that's in our local Smiths or Waterstones. So that is still around 25 years later. So there is something to be said. Yeah, it was 2000, wasn't it? The start of the Ultimate Line or thereabouts. Yeah. So there is something to be said for that. This isn't that. This, they just released it directly as a graphic novel, and it gives the project a bit more prestige, but it takes it longer to earn back its money.
Yeah.
And, as we will discover, longer to actually come out.
Yes.
So that's an issue. Now, DC announced Earth One in 2009, which, as of this recording, is 15 years ago. The first volume was going to be Superman, because they did at least try to pretend on occasion that Superman was their flagship character, and it came out in 2010.
Yeah.
Batman Earth One was supposed to be released in the same year, 2010, but actually came out in 2012. So you're already starting to see the problem that this initiative was experiencing. The second Superman volume had already come out at that point.
Mm.
So that one at least was on some kind of regular schedule. However, Volume 3 of Superman Earth 1 was released in 2015.
Right.
The Batman would drag his cape, and Volume 2 and 3 would only be released in 2015 and 2021. The latter reaching shelves after the audience has literally forgotten that this was a thing.
Yeah.
Nobody more surprised than me when Batman Earth 1 Volume 3 was actually solicited.
Mm.
Do you remember that?
No. Because again, it was just one of those things that just kind of slips out. Yeah.
So other releases scheduled included the Teen Titans and Green Lantern, both of which managed two volumes.
One, two. I know Green Lantern only had one.
Did it? Teen Titans definitely had two, didn't it?
Yeah.
Wonder Woman managed a trilogy.
Three, yeah.
Yeah, and thank you for explaining what a trilogy is. Aquaman and The Flash were scheduled, never released.
Never released.
Never came out.
Morrison tied on to do Earth One for The Flash, but ended up rewriting it into the script for the film, which then got thrown in the bin.
I'd rather have had the Grant Morrison one, to be honest with you. Earth One was announced by Editor-in-Chief Dan Didio as being like a movie. Whereas the regular comics were like a TV show, because God forbid we should be making comics.
That's, you know what, having read these, though, that is a perfect way to describe them. These are like reading films, for better and for worse.
Well, and we'll come to that later. It was also stated by writer Geoff Johns, who was the writer on the Batman stuff, we're planning on doing two novels a year. Oh, when you see it in black and white like that, it's laughable. Oh, we can laugh about it now, but at the time it was terrible. And set in this new universe, continued Johns, we're getting unlimited creative freedom that we couldn't have in current continuity. This was about a year before the New 52. But the impetus was basically the same. Take DC's regular mainstays and reinvent them in a hip, new, edgy style, as I believe the kids don't say at all. Superman Earth 1 was written by J. Michael Straczynski, best known for being the creator of Babylon 5. You can't say it without doing it like that. Well, I can. With art by Shane Davis. And when prepping the book, Straczynski is quoted as saying, "What I'm trying to do is dig into the character and look at him through modern eyes. If you were to create the Superman story today for the first time, but keep intact all that works, what would it look like? As a fledgling writer, I used to love going to see productions of Shakespeare, as they would often move the original play forward in time. You could have Two Gentlemen of Verona set in a pre-World War II Italy, or a female Hamlet, or Richard III set in Nazi Germany. Here we're doing more than that because we're not sticking to a script, but the idea is much the same. In the case of Superman, we take all the elements that work and infuse them with a modern sensibility as if it had just been created today. Did he succeed there, do you think? Okay, well, we'll get into that when I've done my wonderfully written intro. JMS was the obvious choice. He was a longtime Superman fan, although his initial run of the main Superman comic, Grounded, didn't really work for me.
Did Grounded come out before this?
I think I think he quit Superman to do this.
Yeah.
Because didn't he quit Grounded because New 52 got announced and then he decided he didn't want to do a book that didn't matter?
The irony.
And Chris Robertson took over and the back end of Grounded is better than the first end of Grounded. Yeah. And there is a wonderful interview with Chris Robertson. You'd have to find, I think it was on CBR, so it may not even be archived anymore. The guy was not diplomatic about the first half of Grounded.
Yeah.
Shane Davis took over as, was named as the artist. Sorry, he didn't take over anything. I was not aware of him at the time that he drew this. I'm still not, to be brutally honest with you. He drew the 20-year-old Clark wearing layers of clothing, showing him trying to blend in with his associates and differing from previous depictions of Clark wearing a suit, tie and glasses, which Davis said didn't make sense. Okay. David also reimagined Metropolis, which was historically depicted as an expanse of Art Deco buildings, to be a more realistic and, let's be honest, somewhat generic city. The time depicting Clark as he is on that cover was met with quite the controversy, with even Entertainment Weekly moaning about it.
All right.
Nowadays, it seems like a very silly thing to get upset over. He's basically dressed like you. You're literally wearing a red hoodie and a t-shirt as we record this.
Yeah. It's some things kind of work about this. And I think one of the problems with updating and modernizing what is essentially a timeless character is the fact that you then move past that period of time. Mm. We're gone past a decade since this was modernized and there's a lot in it that is already incredibly dated.
Uh-huh.
And things that you kind of mentioned specifically, like the fashion that they were in this is already dated.
Mm.
And there's some of the things in the dialogue again, which border on old man wondering how kids talk. But again, that's already kind of past. And it's weird. It's like a time capsule. These volumes in that this, okay, it's a perfectly accurate representation of how things were 10, 15 years ago, but now kind of rereading this feel more dated than an action comics from the 80s or 90s.
And the 60s.
Yeah.
Because you love the 60s ones. The hardcovers, to their credit, were handsomely designed. I don't know whether Chip Kidd did these. The only issue I have with it is on the side panels. Because it's updated, the DC logo changes.
Yeah.
Stuff like that irritates me. They did do a pretty good job of keeping them uniform.
Yeah. These Earth Ones, I think I wanted more from them. Because I think the Earth One line is a genius concept that might have been a bit too progressive for its time, having them be straight to prestige hardbacks. Because everything about them, whether the inside, you know, is good or not, the outside's the well-designed, the well-done. There was money and thoughts put into this. It's just an absolute shame that, you know, one book might have been delayed because of a particular artist is known for their delays, and that kind of put a spanner in the whole works kind of thing. Yeah.
And you do wonder why, certainly with the Batman one, why Geoff Johns and Gary Frank took so long. And I sometimes wonder, was it that Geoff Johns suddenly became very involved in DC's movie slate.
Mm-hmm.
And did that keep him away from the writing of the comics?
Yeah.
Because he started being very involved from the Green Lantern film and then was apparently very involved in Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman. Yeah. And if you believe Internet Scuttlebutt, was one of the people responsible for getting Zack Snyder ousted from Justice League.
Mm.
If you believe that, I don't know if that's true or not. That was just a popular rumour.
But it is just such a shame because these are nice books and such a good concept.
And these three, we've got the hardcovers. We bought this in hardcover. The paperbacks aren't as nice.
No, they're not.
They should maybe have not done these as paperback releases.
Mm.
They should have just left them as hardcover. Because they are lovely. And I do like that the S stands out. I'm not a big fan of the red glowy eyes of evil on the cover of volumes 1 and 2. Surprisingly not 3. but that was very much
the style of the times. Yeah.
You know, I wore an onion on my belt because that was the style of the time. As Grandpa Simpson once said. Anyway, should I do the brief synopsis of volume 1?
Okey-doke.
Major Sandra Lee is investigating a craft that landed on Earth about 20 years ago. Major Lee, no relation to Lee Majors, is also made aware of a strange series of craft currently approaching Earth. Meanwhile, a young Clark Kent is trying to make his way in the world today. Suddenly it becomes Cheers, and ends up working at the Daily Planet. Clark has a small piece of the craft Lee is investigating, and it suddenly activates, filling Clark's head with strange symbols and images. Coincidentally, this is when Gene Simmons from KISS arrives, leading an advanced warfleet of aliens who reveal that they are after a strange visitor from another planet, hiding here on Earth. Gene, also known as Tyrell, wants the visitor. Did he create replicants, do you think? Clark dons the costume his adopted mother and father gave him, as well as the name Superman. Why have they already designed him a suit and given him a name? Tyrell reveals Krypton's destruction was no accident. His planet Dayron was aided by another mysterious man to drop probes into Krypton's core, causing instability. The deal with the mystery guest was that no Kryptonian be allowed to live, hence Tyrell being here on Earth after Kal-El. If you've not worked out who the mystery man is, we'll give you till volume two. They have world engines, which are being used to destroy Earth. The vessel in Lee's possession flies to Superman, and he uses it to destroy the Daron's vessel, allowing Tyrell and Superman to wail on each other before everything goes boom. Always a boom. Maybe no boom today. Always a boom tomorrow. The wrap-up, Clark sells his story to the Bugle. No, he doesn't. He sells his story to the Daily Planet. That would be a twist. If he went to the Daily Bugle and it's now J. Jonah Jameson and not Perry White and he never meets Lois, I would
read that. It is an alternate universe, after all.
I would read... And he ends up... The photography ends up working with his Peter
Parker.
Oh, brilliant. Anyway, Clark sells his story to the Daily Planet, which gains him a job. Like, because that easy. The military wants Superman by any means necessary, and the people of Earth are undecided. Whatever the case, hero or not, the world will never be the same again. Right, first off, and I think we harped on about this when we did this first time round.
Mm-hmm.
We covered Superman Earth 1, Batman Earth 1, and Wonder Woman Earth 1.
Right, okay.
Because you can listen to it now.
I believe you.
And it doesn't sound like us. Because we're like 5 or 6 years removed.
Yeah.
But this is very, very, very similar to Man of Steel.
Yeah, this predates Man of Steel, doesn't it?
Yes.
You're right.
Yes, it does. Because he changes something in Volume 3 as a reaction to Man of Steel. And he's actually said that in an interview I read.
Right, okay.
It's for First Contact story, Man of Steel. Aliens arrive on Earth looking for Superman, Man of Steel. The World Engines, Man of Steel. Destruction of Metropolis, Man of Steel.
The person behind the destruction.
The person behind the destruction, Man of Steel. Clark searching for who he is as a person, Man of Steel.
Mm.
And really being alienated and not a part of the Earth.
Yeah.
Man of Steel. In both instances, I kind of think that's a misreading of the Clark Kent portion of the character.
Well, this is initially one of my big struggles to get into it, and one of those where I did have to keep reminding myself it's a different universe, it's a different interpretation, this is something different, is right off the bat we're introduced to a Clark Kent who is super great at everything, effortlessly so. And initially that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because I don't know, I don't think that Clark Kent should be better than everyone else. He should be like everyone else. No, but he's super smart. He's a genius. He's a great athlete. Like, the way that he's depicted in this. But then also, to counter that, he's alienated. He's alone. He's isolated. But at the same time, it reads like he's alienating himself, but then going, oh, woe is me. I'm so alone. And it kind of felt like, from the beginning of this, Clark Kent, I already felt was incredibly unlikable.
See, I didn't find him unlikable. I did struggle with the idea that he goes around, he goes and auditions to be a football player.
And immediately gets a contract.
Real name.
Yeah.
And immediately gets a contract for it. He then goes and solves a major scientific problem that has been plaguing the great minds of our time.
Yeah.
And gives his real name.
Yeah.
And then decides he doesn't want to do that. He wants to go and be a newspaper reporter.
To be of the people.
Are these guys really just going to let him go after this?
Well, that guy who's the head of that company comes through it.
Yeah.
And he's kind of depicted as this bad guy because all he cares about is his money and his company. And I'm sat there thinking, well, no, actually, like, why would he get involved in fighting these aliens?
Yeah. It is, it kind of undermines its own point.
Yeah.
In that at this point, he isn't Superman.
Mm.
And at this point, he doesn't know what his life's mission is going to be.
Yeah.
So the fact that he did these two things and then threw it all away to go and work for the planet didn't ring true.
Mm.
There is something in the Byrne version, and was also in Mark Waid's Birthright, and was also a part of Lois and Clark.
Right.
Was this idea that for 8 years, he doesn't just sit in the Fortress of Solitude listening to his dad drone off,
right,
like he does in Superman the movie. He tours the world.
Okay.
He goes around the world. And it may have been Lois and Clark, or it may have been Birthright. I can't remember which one. But one of those establishes that while he was doing that, he was writing stories for local papers at that time. And right. Then I think by Birthright, he was writing it for internet news organisations.
Right, yeah, because Clark Kent is a novelist, isn't he? And
so he was building himself a resume.
Okay.
And by the time he gets to Metropolis and goes to work for the planet, there's a body of work there that he can show to Perry and go, look, I've never had a staff job, but I've been all over the world. I've reported in war zones. I've reported on the ozone. I've reported on deforestation. I've reported on this, and this.
Yeah.
I've a body of work there. I've a career as a writer. He just walks in off the street and gets a job.
And especially when you get to the end as well, and he just hands an interview, which is completely 100% fabricated, and gets a job. And the fact as well that then becomes, I'd say, a plot point in the later volumes. It's barely a plot point.
Yeah, Lois, as you get into volume 2 and 3, Lois is very suspicious of this interview.
But it's just completely dropped because Clark is a great guy.
And they just ignore it. And I suppose you could argue a case it isn't fabricated. He is Superman.
No, but it is completely fabricated. Let's say the movie, for example. The Superman gives the interview to Lois Lane, who is a known journalist who already has a job. Instead of Clark Kent, a complete unknown, coming saying, oh yeah, that alien, he just saved the world. Oh yeah, I met him, he just told me his entire life story, can I have a job?
See, the Byrne one, he gives the interview to Clark, and that's what gets him a job on the planet.
Right.
But I can't remember if the Byrne one is the one where he tours the world first, or if that's Birthright.
Because that's it. Here, why?
Yeah.
And the fact is, Straczynski knows that you're going to ask that question, so has Lois answer that question, but then doesn't feel like he should answer it.
Mm. He gets it. Well, this goes to his quote, doesn't it? We looked at what works and modernised it.
Yeah.
But you didn't.
Yeah.
You've not modernised how this kid, because he's supposed to be, what, are you 20? If that?
Something like that, yeah.
This kid walks into a major metropolitan newspaper
and
gets a job.
Because they do mention that it is dying on its ass, and this interview saved them.
Yeah, but like you say, he gets that interview. It's not a real interview.
And who is he? Who is Clark Kent? No one.
At the very least, you not think he would take that interview and give it to Lois to redraft it and make it a proper article. Where's Clark's experience as a writer come from?
Yeah.
Again, in the one where he tours the world for 8 years, he leaves Smallville at like 18 and goes and tours the world before he's decided he's going to be Superman.
Yeah.
But he's building himself a legacy.
Well, there's a passing mention in this, isn't there, to his time writing the Smallville paper?
Yes. Is that enough to get your job at the Daily Planet?
Well, apparently.
Oh, okay, fair enough. The beginning of this, he arrives off the bus. Is very just the opening of Lois and Clark. That's literally how he arrives in that. And he gets off at the corner of Donner and Swan.
Okay, I didn't notice that. That's cute.
It is quite cute, yeah. You could tell that this is the period of the glowy red eyes of anger, because not only are they on the cover, but when he saves the girl from the mugging, he does it with his glowy red eyes. Me and you were bored of that very, very early on. I'd have to go back and listen to Hey Kids, but I remember us being very bored of that very early.
Right.
And it's,
it was everywhere back. We've calmed down on it now. Like, I think DC writers have started to remember who Superman is a bit more now that we don't see this as much.
I don't know if this is a controversial opinion.
Okay.
I don't think Dan DiDio really understood Superman. And I think Dan DiDio struggled with how to make Superman work in a modern context.
Yeah.
And I think an awful lot of the ridiculous criticism that Superman's too powerful and how'd you write for such a character came from that era where the comics didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah.
And then you look at Superman and Lois, which is all three seasons are now on iPlayer.
All right.
So four seasons not started in America yet. You make him relatable through the Clark Kent persona.
Which is why it exists in the first place.
Exactamente. And that is something I don't think this gets.
Well, this, I found this fascinating, genuinely fascinating in this first volume, because on one hand, it perfectly encapsulates every reason why Superman should be relevant, whilst also undermining it at every turn. This is a complicit in those arguments of why Superman isn't relevant, but also tries to argue for why it is. And it doesn't... The biggest problem I have with all of them is that this is all completely perfunctory.
Mm.
It's like J. Michael Straczynski, he had his list in front of him as everything that a good story should have in it. And he went through and he wrote the script and he ticked all of these boxes off, but that's it. This doesn't trigger any emotions. Everything that happens in this story is just perfectly perfunctory. It's not bad, it's not good, it just is what it is. And that's it with Superman as well. Is it brings up this argument of like, why should he be relevant? Oh, because he can stand for immigration. And then that's it.
Mm.
They don't show that. They just say that, well, you know, he might do.
Yeah. It's, for me, I always think that the fundamental problem with people writing Superman, when they say stuff like he's too powerful and they don't know what to do with him and he's alienated and they're playing with that aspect of the character, they're ignoring that that's what Clark Kent's for.
Yeah.
Clark has grown up around people. Clark grew up with a relatively normal childhood.
Which is why I didn't buy into the whole I need to isolate myself aspect, but then I'm going to feel sorry for myself for being isolated, because at least the Clark Kent that I grew up with had Lana Lang and he had his mates that he hung out with in Smallville.
And Smallville would have been a very, very boring TV show for 10 seasons if he was isolated.
Yeah.
That the whole point of that show that they got right in a lot of cases was it was a coming of age story, but with Clark Kent.
Yeah.
And I'd struggle when you make Clark this difficult to like.
And I do wonder how much of this comes from, we've discussed in the past how, at least maybe in the last 10 years or so, Bruce Wayne hasn't really existed because it's been Batman. And the argument that, oh, Bruce Wayne is the mask.
Yeah.
How much of that bled over into Superman? Because you even get a line in this saying Clark Kent is the mask.
Mm.
And I genuinely, even as an alternate Earth story, completely disagree with and undermines that character and makes it so harder to relate with him. That's what I mean. Of course, he's super great at everything. How are you going to relate to him in that regard?
But Clark's the real person.
Yeah.
Clark's the person who's been brought up by the Kents.
Yeah.
Clark is the person who went to Smallville High and did whatever he did for those years that he was in school.
So,
Superman's the idol, the icon.
So by making your character so isolated, you're then isolating your readers from that character.
Yeah.
And that is, it made this harder to get into at the start.
Yeah. See, I buy this with Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne comes from money. He's gone to rich schools because his father left quite a lot of cash behind.
Yeah.
He's not really grown up with real people.
Right.
Has he?
So
Bruce Wayne would be a slightly disaffected youth.
Yeah, yeah.
Which leads him down the path to becoming Batman.
Yeah.
Because that's how he perceives that he can do a good thing. The Bruce Wayne persona is an affectation.
Mm.
It's what he thinks a play... Christian Bale nailed that.
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah.
Christian Bale nailed that this is what he thinks a playboy would act like.
Yeah.
He doesn't know that from experience.
Yeah.
He's acting. Bruce Wayne is the act.
Yeah.
Whereas Clark is a real person who's grown up with real people and real parents. I never liked this idea that Clark is somehow disaffected youth and one step away from being the guy who would, you know, shoot up a mall.
Because even the film, to a degree, kind of depicted that version of Clark.
But even that, though, by the time you get to 3, that's, they've settled down. When he goes back to the Smallville High reunion,
yeah,
And you clearly see that Clark had a life in Smallville.
Yeah.
And he had a relationship with Lana. It may not have been the relationship he wanted, but he had one.
Yeah.
Even Christopher Reeve pulled back from Clark the Klutz as you get into the third film. I'm not really a massive fan of a Clark Kent who's just isolated himself for 20 years from the planet.
Yeah.
Because then you're kind of like, well, why is he sworn to protect us?
But again, it's one of those things where you just have to keep reminding myself it's an alternate take. Mm. And, you know, just because I think that Superman 3 is the best Clark Kent story there is doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that's the buy-all and end-all.
Superman Lois is very good.
Yeah,
okay. I'm going to champion that cause. There's a couple of things worth noting in this version. It is heavily photo-referenced. That Lois Lane, that's Jennifer Carpenter.
Right.
From Dexter. I'm pretty sure Jimmy's based on somebody, but I can't quite place him.
There's something about the art, and I remember feeling this when I first read it, is, again, what I was saying about the writing being perfunctory, the art is as well, and the art kind of borders from, the still scenes are very, very rendered, and then the action scenes are a bit more lifeless.
Yeah.
There's a lot of this that just feels lifeless.
I've got, if you have a read there, I've got exactly that note. It's very realistic.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of wonder to it.
And it
or jaw-dropping excitement.
Yeah.
There's no wow factor.
And I don't want to say it ever gets ugly, but there are certain times where things get a bit wonky and that kind of thing. Like, I don't know, maybe the deadline was coming up. But yeah, it's kind of, it's just all lifeless. And the writing felt lifeless and the art felt lifeless. And it just needed just something to it.
I didn't find it lifeless, more as I found it a little bit stiff.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's no wow factor to it. There's no dun-dun-dun-dun moment. There's no shirt rip moment.
Yeah.
There's no moment of... Even Man of Steel had the bit where he learns to fly, which is probably the only genuine bit of joy in that film. Apart from the bit at the end where he gets the sound from Kansas.
Okay.
After he's just snapped somebody's neck. So he's obviously grieving. But... Yeah, I found the same thing with the whole portrayal of this, that it's very, I think I've got this a little later on, so I won't say it again later, but it's got that same vibe Man of Steel has, that they want to make it real. It has to be real, realistic all the time. This is a guy who wears a red cape and flies.
Yeah.
The main difference for me between Superman the movie is you'll believe a man can fly.
Yeah.
It won't be realistic.
Right.
But you'll believe it.
But you're selling the illusion.
Yeah. And the problem with this that I add is that it is very much that Man of Steel vibe of it's an alien invasion that is being drawn as if it's an everyday occurrence.
Mm.
There's nothing like that moment in Independence Day or V.
Right.
Where the motherships arrive through the clouds and everyone goes, wow. There's none of that.
Which it's kind of one of those things, maybe by volume 3 and it's treated as an everyday occurrence. Let's say you've got alien invasion shelters and bunkers and that kind of thing. So by the time you've gotten later on, it would be. The recent Monarch TV show had quite an interesting aspect. Japan has now installed Godzilla bunkers, kind of like, you know, the Blitz raids, that kind of thing. So it kind of makes sense that it would become an everyday occurrence. But here, yeah, you're right. It is the first time this happens, and yet it's just, here they are.
It's treated as if they were expecting it, and it's not a new thing. That was a little bit disappointing. Overall, I didn't mind it. You know, there's very definite some J. Michael Straczynski tropes in here. Perry White is the character who, you know, plants himself and will not move if his principles are threatened. Everything Straczynski's wrote as that guy in it.
Okay, right.
Krypton doesn't blow up. It was sabotaged. Which I think... I don't remember if that got any kind of pushback, but if you remember Superman, J.J. Abrams was attached to Superman at one point.
Right.
And the script leaked. And the script was Krypton didn't blow up.
Okay.
And that's a similar vibe.
Yeah. I don't mind that. It makes it quite interesting if the actual villain behind it was interesting.
Yeah, and not the one that you think it's going to be from the minute they're mentioning here that there was a mysterious bad guy.
And it's genuinely hilarious. And like I said earlier, Straczynski knows that you're going to question it, so he brings it up, but then doesn't follow through with it. Is in the middle of this fight, Clark Kent learns everything about who he is and where he came from because the bad guy just decides to tell him. And then Superman turns around and goes, "Oh my god, I always thought that was dead cringe when villains did that." And it's like, come on.
I thought that was, just because you're hanging a lantern on it, don't make it not true.
Yeah.
Because I'm reading this again, I've got the notes somewhere further down. They're fighting and they're wailing on each other, and then they'll just stop and have a chat. And I'm like, no.
But that only exists because that's probably in the writer's handbook of how to tell the story. Again, it's just, let's interrupt the fight so that we can have reams and reams and reams of dialogue giving you your entire backstory, because I actually haven't done that yet.
Well, there is a thing here, and I think you can argue a case. Straczynski is a little bit in love with his own writing.
Mm. There's so much dialogue. And this is, I think, where it comes back to what we said about it does read like a film. This reads like a screenwriter. It reads like
which
a
is what
script.
He is.
Yeah. The artwork isn't showing you. The dialogue is telling you just so much. There's a bit in the third volume as well where there's a massive text bubble just in one small panel.
Yep. Yeah, there is. So that was one issue I thought I had with it. Things I did like. I did like the updating of the origin, that the Kents were hiking when they find the spaceship, because that's nice. So there's no car with a license plate, so they can't track them down.
Mm.
They are literally just walking in the woods, so no one will have known they were there.
Yeah.
They've just gone, should we go out for a walk today? It's going to be a nice day. I liked that. That was kind of like the Smallville thing, that it was a meteor shower.
Right.
So that
covered up. Yeah, okay.
The ship landing, because nowadays satellites would pick that up,
yeah,
which wouldn't have been an issue in 1938. So I thought that was quite a good update. But I didn't think that them naming him Superman and giving him an outfit made any sense.
Yeah, and there's so many instances of that, I think, where he has a specific memory that is relevant to what is happening now.
Mm.
That happens throughout it so much. Then, yeah. Where did he get his costume from? His mum made that costume exactly how it is now and gave him the name Superman because he is a Superman.
Why?
Yeah.
At least, you know, Superman the movie, you give it a pass.
Right.
He gets the suit in the Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah.
There's always been the question though, well, why is it not white?
Yeah.
Nobody on Krypton wears colours.
But even the argument of like his cape is the blanket he came in. This specifically states his mum made it a cape.
Yeah.
Why? And did she make those boots as well? Those Chanel boots?
Yeah,
come on.
The Buccaneer. Because again, in the Byrne version and Lois and Clark, he's done his first super feats.
Yeah.
And he goes back home and says, right, well, I don't know what to do now. The genie's out of the bottle.
Right.
And his parents say, right, well, you need something that will distract people from who you are.
Yeah.
And that's where the suit comes from.
And it's cute as well. The great bit in the TV show, it's like, oh, I love your cape. Thanks, my mum made it.
Yeah. That's in Superman and Lois,
It works, but it doesn't work if his mum made him the suit
beforehand.
First. Yeah.
Yeah. This is like the problem I have with Lois and Clark is, why is he wearing his glasses before he's Superman?
Right, okay.
They just kind of gloss over that a little bit, so whatever. But yeah, that didn't make any sense to me. It's like, well, we need him. Again, which bits work?
Yeah.
In a modern context. So just having the suit already doesn't work in a modern context.
Is he Superman because he decided that the right thing to do would be to protect the people of his new planet, his new home? Or is he Superman because his mum made him a nice costume and said, no, you have to go be a superhero?
It kind of takes the decision away from him, doesn't it? And that, again, that's something that I had a problem with throughout all of this. Superman is reactive. Clark is reactive throughout the entire thing.
Mm.
He never won, again, Man of Steel, where he's reactive.
Yeah.
He's reactive. He would have stayed hidden for the rest of his life, just saving people on oil rigs if Zod hadn't shown up.
He spends half of this invasion moping about as well. You know, I kind of feel like he would have jumped in and done something, because he even actively tries to not get involved. He goes back to the CEO guy and go, look, we can reverse engineer this. He does everything he can to not do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the first shot of Superman And it's literally just him just hovering in the air.
Yeah.
Where's the flying out of the fortress moment?
And he looks bored, just like he's walking.
Yeah, he looks like he doesn't really want to be here. It isn't an awe-inspiring flash page like the first time you see him flying in Man of Steel 1 by John Byrne or Christopher Reeve flying out of the fortress. Or again, even Man of Steel, where he flies for the first time. At least that's awe-inspiring.
Right.
At least that's, all right, well, the film's going to kick off from here. At least there's that moment of joy. That's flat, isn't it? You compare that to the panel burn, Drew, at the end of Man of Steel. It's dull.
Yeah.
And there's other things as well. Major Lee does not look old enough to have been investigating Clark for 20 years. She also looks like Emily Van Camp, who at the time will have been better known for the TV show Everwood, but is now Sharon Carter in the Marvel movies.
Right.
So there's a little bit of photo reference there. The book, what did you think of this? It's also, this is a Dan DiDio thing.
Okay.
No one in this book is allowed to be old or unattractive.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Dan DiDio's thing right all the way through. That shot of him becoming Clark Kent is dreadful.
It's, yeah. Also, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Did we really wear, like, shirts with cardigans? We did, didn't we?
We did. We wore shirts with cardigans.
And then the glasses don't work in this as well. Like, he just decides to wear glasses because...
Yeah. It's, you need, if in a modern context, you need to come up with the reasons that he does this. One of the problems with Smallville running as long as it did was so many people had seen Clark at that point do super feats.
Right.
That it's just suddenly going to be, why have you started wearing specs?
Okay.
It that got a little bit ridiculous, but at least he tried to cover it. And yeah, there's just some of it. I don't know. I mean, the final act is exceptionally Man of Steel. There's an almighty level of property damage and destruction, as you would expect from an alien invasion. You know, in Independence Day, they blow up the White House, don't they?
Yeah.
So there's going to be a level of destruction to it. But this is what we've talked about. It's quite boring. Set up the camera and shoot it as if it's a news documentary.
Mm.
That's what it feels like. It's not drawing from even something like literally like Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke. It's just boring.
Yeah.
Boringly choreographed, boringly staged. And a lot of it is all down to this decision to make everything as uber realistic as you can and rob it of some of its mythic quality.
Mm.
There's no joy to it.
It's being wrapped up too much in the modernizing it.
Yeah. Even though in the reading of it, it was fine. The suit looks more like the Superman Returns suit.
Yeah.
You know, I think.
Yeah.
With the shorter briefs and it's more burgundy than red.
Mm.
The boots are more Buccaneer boots. But yeah, the art's competent.
It's all just competent. Like this is it. Like just this volume in and of its own.
Yeah.
Didn't dislike it, but I didn't like it. It's just, oh well, I've just read something. That's it.
Yeah.
I didn't dislike it enough to dislike it. I didn't like enough to like it. Everything served its purpose. Everything was just done well. Everything was just, it was just fine.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? Straczynski is too good a writer for him to write something terrible.
But it feels like he's just going, oh well, I need my symbolism, or well, I need this, and he just goes through to write.
It feels like I need to write a Superman story. Here's a checklist of things that need to be in a Superman origin story.
Yeah,
and some of the modernization elements of it now don't work as well 15 years down the line.
Yeah,
as the more traditional elements of it from the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
Or even the reboots like Man of Steel and Lois and Clark and the comic Man of Steel and Birthright.
Mm.
Even those updatings of it feel better than this.
And it's kind of weird because you would have thought that Straczynski would have gotten Superman. And it's not that he doesn't get Superman. It's, again, it's too wrapped up in the idea of modernizing and reinterpreting, even as an alternate universe kind of story, because just everything about him just feels just nearly there. Just nearly.
Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's too serious.
But then even when it does try to be funny, it's eye-rolling. There's this scene where these guys were just on, oh, nothing ever happens around here. Nope, nothing ever happens. And then Superman a satellite fly, crashes. Yeah. Superman flies by them. But they're too distracted by saying, nothing ever happens to see. It's like, come on.
Yeah. I do like the polar bear. Yeah. That's clearly a nod to one of the Kevin Smith Superman films.
Right, okay.
Where the guy was insisting there are polar bears.
Right.
And it's like, does it matter? Yes, apparently it matters that there are polar bears.
But I mean, the dialogue's nice throughout. There's a very definite inspiration from the films in this. Mm. But you get to the point where just, we get it. You like writing dialogue.
Yeah. Like I said, it's too serious. It's like Superman Returns and Man of Steel. This is important.
Yeah.
It's not allowed to be frivolous. There's no levity. There's no fun. There's no joy. Even, like we say, Man of Steel had the bit where he learns to fly.
Mm.
And you had that moment where, right, Superman's arrived. Compare this, right, to All-Star.
Yeah.
All-Star Superman, where Superman makes his debut in that comic flying through the sun.
Mm.
And then, whatever you may think of Morrison as writer, you love him. I think he's hit and miss. When he's good, he's great.
Yeah.
When he's not, I find it a little bit borderline pretentious and incomprehensible.
Mm.
But say what you want about him, every page of All-Star Superman is infused with joy and wonder.
Yeah.
And incredible science fiction concept.
Or just shortly after this, we had Action Comics, which was written off the back of Morrison writing Super Gods. And even if you don't like that modernization, reinterpretation of it, again, that's fun because you've got this spunky teenager dressed like Bruce Springsteen using his powers to jump around and fight for the little man.
Yeah. So even though he's taken his influence from the older Golden Age stuff, I mean, it's like we've said, it's not bad. But it's a story that likes its character motivations and dialogue more than the action and the art.
Mm.
I often do think about Straczynski, would he be happier writing novels and plays?
Right, yeah.
Which are dialogue and character heavy. It's thoughtful, it's sometimes provocative, but its quest for realism spoils some of it. And I like that we were on exactly the same page though. That we've come to exactly the same conclusion. By making these things ultra realistic, you take something away.
Yeah. It's sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I don't think the thing with superheroes is you can try to make it realistic, but they are still superheroes.
Yeah.
And you can't, this wants to be the Superman story rather than a Superman story.
I mean, at this point, how many origins had you had? Man of Steel in 86, Birthright in 2000.
Right.
Then the New 52 came along and did another origin for him.
Yeah.
Then you've got this. And then since this, you've had the Frank Miller, John Romita Jr. one. And at the end of the day, yeah, Frank Miller and John Romita Jr. did a Black Label Superman origin, I think.
Oh, God, yeah, I forgot about that.
I've never read it, so I don't know if it's any good. I think I read the first issue. I've not read all of it. I mean, I don't know if I ever see it for cheap.
No, yeah, I remember that.
I may be inclined to pick it up. Volume 2 is by exactly the same creative team. It sees career criminal Raymond Maxwell Jensen infiltrate Star Labs research facility to destroy evidence of his crimes. But, and you saw this coming if you've ever read a superhero comic, he is accidentally exposed to high-energy neutrino that transforms him into an energy-absorbing supervillain called the Parasite. Unable to satiate his newfound hunger, Parasite decides that Superman might be powerful enough to feed him. Good. I love Parasite.
Yes.
Parasite's a great villain.
Like, generally, or in this?
Generally.
Okay.
Before this. I love Parasite.
Yeah, okay, no.
Meanwhile, our young Superman is still trying to do good, despite certain countries saying that they don't even want him in their airspace. When a tsunami is about to hit the island of Barada, Superman is prevented from assisting by the ruthless dictator General Samza, who will kill his own people if Superman does not leave, telling Superman the man with the gun has the power. Lois thinks there's something off about young Clark, and instead of doing her job, starts investigating Clark, an investigation that reveals Clark is so boring and ordinary, he must be hiding something. Major Lee is still of the belief that Superman needs dealing with and is pressuring the United States to develop countermeasures that, should he go rogue, they can take him down. But Clark is busy getting hot under the collar with his new neighbour, Lisa LaSalle, who wants to take him to a midnight screening of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But Parasite has made the highly logical leap that because Jimmy Olsen got a picture of Superman, then he must know how to reach him. We'll go with it. The attack ruins Clark's time with Lisa as Superman responds. After a fight, Superman is completely drained and powerless. Superman 2, basically. He retires to the Fortress of Solitude, where the computer AI creates a war suit for him to help defeat Parasite, but the AI tells him it will also block the sun's energy. So if Parasite breaches the suit and absorbs Superman's power again, Superman will die. As the Parasite slowly becomes more deranged, we learn he was always a bad un, but did at least love his sister, Teresa. Teresa was headed to Metropolis, again the subject of major destruction, having recognised her brother. But when he hugs her accidentally, because how dumb is he accidentally absorbs her energy, killing her. Of course, this isn't his own stupid fault. No, no, it's all Superman's. And Parasite again attacks the planet. Superman fights back, aided by the suit, and wins. Parasite is taken into the custody of Major Lee's team. The wrap-up. Clark overhears Lisa screaming in her apartment and finds she's being attacked, pretty much revealing who he is. But she's not smart enough to figure that out, as we'll see in Volume 3. He takes her attacker to Alaska and just dumps him there. Yeah. Lisa tells Clark she has had to do a bit of sex work to earn extra money, but Clark being Clark offers no judgment, just friendship. Well, he can't catch a sexually transmitted disease, can he? So back in Barada, Superman instigates a rebellion against General Samsa, leading the country to democratic reform, because it's just that easy. Telling the general the man with the gun has the power, see what he did there, he arms the rebellion. This will not come back to bite him on the arse at all, I'm sure. Lois abandons the investigation into Clark after hearing his new story about another of his neighbours who died of a heroin overdose. Why would that cause... Whatever. Major Lee recruits the wealthy scientist Lex Luthor and his wife Alexandra to help find a way to kill Superman. Okay, because of issues on the website that houses the podcast, I've had to cut this in two. If you listen to this on Spotify, you get the whole thing unexpurgated, but part two will be along in your feed ASAP. Thank you very much.